Hello, you nimble finger dancers. You keyboard quick steppers. You citizens of our great nation, the imagination. You mediums of the muse. You slinky, inky curators of chronicles. You jackanories. You telltale tits. Hello, and thrice hello. Hello, hello. Welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast.
Can I kick off, Tommy, with a highly controversial statement?
Yes.
I was awake like 4:30 in the morning because the windows were open and the little inconsiderate birdies were chirping away. And I started thinking about, I don't know why I was thinking this, but I was thinking about the word writer.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, the word writers, it seemed a little bit inadequate at 4:30 in the morning. And I decided there and then that we should stop using it. Because everyone writes, don't they? Most people, at least.
So it's like saying someone's a speaker or a walker.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really a, I don't know, it doesn't sound like an actual thing, a job. Because people write emails, they write letters to get off parking tickets, they write shopping lists. I thought it doesn't quite encapsulate the essence of what it is to create via the media of language.
Does author help you with that one? Because they've invented a word that does this?
Well, it does, but that only covers a certain kind of writer, doesn't it? And I quite like wordsmith.
It's a bit poncy, that, though, isn't it?
It's a bit wanky.
But that would explain why you like it, yeah.
Yeah. But it does at least conjure, romantic images of someone in a dark room, you know, beaded with sweat.
Slaving away over a hot typewriter.
Hammering sentences into shape.
Yeah.
It gives a sense of the graft involved in writing. So I quite like it for that reason. But also, I made one up, which I think is vastly superior.
Oh, God. Go on, then. Yeah, I'm going to share it now.
Yes! Yes, I am, Tommy.
Go on, then.
So get ready for this, Tommy. You're going to like this.
I'm ready. So there's no preamble. You're quite confident about this.
Oh, no. Yeah, this is what people are going to start using.
Because if you weren't sure, we'd have a little bit of build-up, wouldn't we? I've seen you sell advertising in the past. If you weren't sure what was going on, if it was any good, you'd give it the full.
Yeah.
So what I was thinking was this.
That's right.
But you're just going to go straight into it. You're confident. So sorry, just to clarify, this word, is this across the board? This covers everything? This covers all
covers
writing?
Everything. Yeah, yeah. That's why it works, I think, instead of writing.
Right. But it gives an air of specialism and talent and work and sweat and toil.
Just the hugeness of the task.
Everything involved in being
there you go.
An author. I mean, the word is there, but you come up with a new one, it's fine.
That word is worldwright. WRIGHT. A builder of worlds. What do you think of that, Tommy? It's pretty nice, isn't it?
Like a playwright, but bigger.
That's it, You build worlds. If you ask someone what they did for a living at a party, well, let's try it. Let's pretend we're at a party, right?
Are we going to do the full middle-aged person thing and talk about what roads we used to get there? Or we can do that if you want. Well,
yeah.
I came on the A33 because often because of the... Are we just going to pretend we're cool and not do that?
Somewhere in between, I reckon. Right. So let's imagine that our
wives... Do we know
wives,
each other?
They've already started talking, obviously, because they used to go to like a life drawing class together or something. And we're stood silently next to them, like lemons.
Yeah, all right, go on.
And then one of us strikes up a conversation. So I'll be the world right.
Yeah.
And okay. you go for it. Okay.
So it's John, isn't it? Is it John?
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you do for a living? Model? Or, I mean, Playboy? What's your...
I am I'm actually a world right. That's what I do.
So... Sorry, you're a...
A world right, yeah. Are you not familiar with the term?
A world right?
Yeah.
Is that like, town planning? Or what is it?
No, I'm a world right, a builder of new worlds, a creator of souls.
Sorry, I think someone's calling me from over there. I'll catch up with you.
All right,
in a bit, maybe, yeah?
All right, no worries.
Lovely to meet you.
Yeah, you too. I didn't catch your name. Right.
Yeah, no, I'm not
it's
sure.
It's not going to work, is it? It's not going to work.
I see where you're coming from, kind of that. But
yeah, I've realised what the problem is. P- people won't actually know what you're talking about, for starters. And also, everyone will think you're a massive prick. But I still think those are small considerations.
Yeah.
If we're looking at the wider picture here.
When you're changing the perspective of the world, John, you're going to hit bumps in the road like that. You can't
That's it, exactly. You're going to get people like that guy at the party.
What an arsehole.
Who just wasn't interested.
Yeah. It's their problem, not yours.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Exactly. Anyway, we'll work on it. We'll work on it.
Yeah.
Well, I'll work on it. You'll just ignore
it. I'm not sure it's needed, but you know, if you feel there's something...
Well, I did it 4:30 in the morning. I've got to be honest,
John,
Tom.
John, if we all just started putting all our heart and soul into something that we thought about at 4:00 in the morning, there'd be some weird stuff going on. I'll tell you that much for nothing.
Yeah, that's true. Because it doesn't feel as important now.
It's weird that, isn't it? There's something about the middle of the night that does that, that can make something, a lot worse or a lot more important than it is. But, good.
Anyway, talking of important stuff, what we got today, Tommy?
Well, following on from last week, this is obviously a little bit of a bonus episode that we're not meant to be doing, but we keep doing them. We are speaking to Joanna Frank, who used to be Louise Voss's agent from last week.
Exactly, who Louise Voss talked about very fondly. So if you haven't heard that one yet, you probably shouldn't listen to this one until you've gone back and listened to that.
Week. But yeah, so we have a chat with her about Louise, obviously, and then about Joanna's sort of journey through the publishing industry as well, which is fascinating.
Yeah, and we even finish off with some very hot querying tips.
Yes, that's true,
So if you're thinking of querying your book, then yeah, have a little listen to this.
Some serious do's and don'ts.
So today we're getting a different perspective on the world of writing, because we're with someone who has not only worked as an editor in various publishing houses, but also as a very highly regarded agent and is now a freelance literary consultant. It's Joanna Frank. Hello, Jo. Thanks for joining us on the Failing Writers podcast.
It's a great pleasure to be here. An honour to be invited. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Now, we got in touch with you, Jo, after speaking to the lovely Louise Voss.
Yes.
Who was singing your praises, actually.
I mean, the moment she described when I rang her up, having read her manuscript, is still, it's funny, it is one of those experiences in my career that's imprinted very firmly on my memory, because I can still remember the feeling of getting to the end of that manuscript. And I think she explained to you that there was a song for each chapter, and she produced a CD of each of those songs. So I did it properly, and I listened to each song alongside each chapter. And I can still hear those sounds in my head. And you know how music is so evocative. It creates a feeling in you. But it was such a clever idea on her part to have that alongside the words, because immediately it enhanced the emotion you felt just reading the words. And I do remember ringing her at 9:30 in the evening, thinking, is this too late to ring somebody? But then on the other hand, if it's an author who's waiting to hear what you think of their book, I reckon it's never too late if somebody's ringing up and being positive. It was a very exciting time. And as you know, it was devastating to discover that she was thinking of giving it all up.
Yeah, I think one of the things she was saying was about how even as a successful writer like she is, there's still the massive ups and downs of reeling in a big contract in an advance, maybe, and then
absolutely
you can go for a couple of years where it's just like, oh, hold on a minute, what's I thought I'd made it, I thought I'd got somewhere, and you're just back into a vacuum.
For an author, you're only as good as the sales figures for your last book.
Yeah.
And of course, all writers, even very successful ones, go through peaks and troughs. And I don't know any writer, even the most successful, who doesn't have massive crises of confidence. Unfortunately, it's the nature of the beast, and you do kind of wonder why. I've also been on that side of the equation as well. You wonder why any of us would do it to ourselves. I think you have to be a bit of a masochist to pursue that as a career, which is not to put anybody off, but it is tough.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
As Louise said, the industry, if you're a very exciting debut novelist, you probably got a much better chance than somebody with a fantastic steady track record, which isn't how it should be. That's not to say that there aren't publishers who do really stick with writers, because there are.
Why do you think that is? Is that just because they're chasing the next big thing and they want the kind of the big impact of a big debut novel?
I think it's novelty. I mean, I'm talking primarily about the fiction market, which is the bit that I know best. The trouble with promoting fiction is it's harder from a PR point of view than nonfiction, but I think for obvious reasons, so that you're always looking for the story to tell. So if you think of somebody like Zadie Smith, for example, if you read her first novel, White Teeth, and, you know, she was fresh out of Cambridge, and she, I think, written the novel while she was still at university, and, you know, she was the great new discovery. There's a story to tell. Whereas somebody who's just been steadily writing away and got a growing fan base, you hope. I think publishers sometimes run out of things to, you know, how do we go on promoting this person? Unless, of course, there's a new kind of, as it were, breakthrough book. So one of the sort of prime examples of this in my experience is the author Jojo Moyes, if you're aware of her.
Yeah, you represented her, didn't you?
I represented her for her early novels. And you know, she's a fantastic writer. Her sales were building steadily, but she wasn't taking off. She'd won a couple of prizes. She won a Romantic Novelists Award prize, which is quite a kind of prestigious prize, actually, in the women's fiction area. But her sales just hadn't taken off. And she'd done, I don't know how many novels she'd written, maybe 8 or 9. And then she came up with this idea for Me Before You. And as I understand it, I wasn't representing her at that time, sadly, because I had moved on. But I think her publisher at the time weren't keen on the idea. And she ended up going to one of the publishers who had turned her down when I was first submitting her. And, you know, the rest is history, you know, became a huge success, turned into a film. So you could, you know, you can, somebody can have a sort of rebirth in that way, but it can often take a change of publisher or a, you know, high concept new idea. Sometimes authors even will start again with a new name,
right? Wow.
As a way of relaunching, because booksellers, understandably, all the time are looking at sales figures.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Are we going to stock this book? Let's have a look at what the last one sold.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can kind of understand that everybody needs to make money, but no, it's tougher and tougher. But on the other hand, there are other avenues, you know, that are opening up with social media in particular, and with self-publishing on Amazon. So there are more options potentially open.
Yeah. It strikes me that if you're good at both marketing and writing these days, you've got a better chance of making it. And I'm not sure that's not everybody's skill set, obviously.
No. Exactly. And I mean, I think that's right. It does certainly give you an advantage if you do have a social media presence. Not everybody uses that well. I mean, there's one author, for example, on Twitter who shall remain nameless, but she almost never tweets. But what she does is occasionally retweets a flurry of other people's nice tweets about her book. Well, that's one way of doing it. The people who tend to be more successful are the ones who go for the what you might call the pull rather than push, the people who look for a more wider engagement rather than buy my fantastic book.
But you have to have a genuine interest in doing that, don't you? That's not something you can fake for any length of time, is it, without going mad? That's just something that you're naturally inclined to do.
I think that's right. And I think it's true for any kind of publicity,
because
you can be a great writer, but absolutely hate the idea of any sort of public appearance or, you know, having to do some authors absolutely love publicity and they know the benefits, but some authors would rather do anything than have to, as I say, have to kind of go out in public.
I think Louise is one of those people.
Yeah.
A little bit, isn't she? She's not massively keen on. In fact, she very openly said that she wasn't mad keen on doing podcasts and things like that.
And that was before we talked to her.
I suspect in Louise's case, that's probably more a natural modesty.
Well, it's almost like there's the extra categories, isn't there? The people that don't like doing it and can't do it, the people that like doing it and can do it. But then you've got the middle ground of people that don't really like doing it but are still actually quite good at it.
Yes.
And I think maybe that's where Louise might fall in that middle category.
Exactly.
Having the talent to do it, but maybe not the desire. Sometimes.
Not relishing it particularly. Yeah, exactly. And I know that, I mean, I think it's probably gone hand in hand a bit with, you know, the fact that you can do self-publishing as Louise did for a time through Amazon. And social media does give those authors a platform for promoting themselves.
Yeah. Inevitably, though, I mean, like you say, on Twitter, it does turn into some kind of weird bun fight, doesn't it? Some kind of very Do you mean there's
a lot of people shouting and not a lot of people listening sometimes? Yeah.
Exactly, which is why I think, you know, the clever way to do it is to engage people, not even necessarily about your book, but just gently to engage people. It's more about a subconscious awareness than a sort of buy my book.
Yeah. So, Jo,
yes.
Start telling us a little bit about you, because you've had obviously a massive wealth of experience in the industry. What was your pathway into the world of publishing?
Did an English degree, inevitably. About halfway through my degree, I decided that my ambitions to become an actress weren't going to suit me after all, because I wasn't going to handle the continual rejection. Little no.
I think I had the same thing. Yeah.
And somehow decided that, you know, I loved reading, I loved writing, didn't want to teach. I know I'll go into publishing without really knowing anything about it. And in those days, as a female in particular, if you wanted to get into publishing, everybody said you had to learn to type.
Right.
I knew I wanted to be an editorial because I wanted to work with the authors and with the books. And so I did it's a sort of apprenticeship as an editorial assistant working for a more senior editor. And funny enough, the person who hired me actually left the job when I'd only been there for about a month to go elsewhere. Mm. And I worked for somebody else. And a couple of years, two or three years later, she then called me up and said, I need an editor to work with me. Will you come over here and work with me? And I moved then to Random House.
Oh, nice.
And at that stage started kind of being able to work on my own with authors and, you know, given books to edit. I think it's changed a bit now, but there weren't any sort of internships. There were very few graduate training schemes or anything like that. It was a question of working your way up and to a little bit of kind of making a good impression and who you know and who you meet along the way.
How many authors are you working with at any one time?
Gosh, it's so variable.
Right.
I mean, it depends whether, you know, if you're the person running the list, because I went from there to Simon & Schuster to run the fiction list. So I would have been working with many more authors then, although I was having to kind of build the list and acquire people from scratch, because you've got books at different stages. So it's very difficult to say how many you've got at any one time, because you might have one author who's not delivering their manuscript for another year, but you still need to be kind of looking out for them, looking after them.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have probably, when I was at Simon & Schuster and running the fiction list, it would have been sort of four or five books publishing a month, probably.
Mm. Wow.
All of which have to be edited, covers briefed. But it's a sort of rolling process, as you can imagine, because you're acquiring new books the whole time, but they might not be published for another year or two hence. Mm. I think a lot of writers are very surprised when they first get taken on at how long it takes.
Yeah, yeah.
From the moment your book being acquired to finding its way onto the shelf.
And in terms of those books that you're looking after and publishing, how many of those would be like, wow, oh my God, this is amazing? Does it have to be like that with every single one? Or are you looking at sort of the market as well and kind of appreciating that it might not be something that you're 100% on, but you can see how it works within the marketplace?
Yes. Your second point, that there's an element of that. Obviously, you hope to love and believe in every book that you take on, but you're right. There'll be some that you acquire. You might not absolutely love them. They might, or at least they might not be something you would go out and buy yourself to take on holiday, but you can absolutely see their merit and you can see what the market would be and you can see how to publish them. Those are the kind of criteria, really. I mean, I suppose it's relatively rare to find books that you absolutely immediately fall in love with. I mean, for example, in the way that I did with Louise's first novel, where you're so moved by it and you think, wow, this is, you know, I absolutely believe in this writer and I would pick this book up and read it if I saw it in the airport or whatever. But no, you have your commercial hat on as well. You have to, because you can't expect to absolutely love everything. Because there aren't enough of those books around, you'd never.
That would just make you really annoying in the workplace, I would imagine, as well, wouldn't it? If you're just floating around going, oh my God, look at this one!
Exactly.
Yeah, it wouldn't really fit within the industry that well.
It would be like the sort of equivalent of crying wolf, I suppose. If you said everything was wonderful and you loved it, you'd get nobody would believe you, would they? Oh God, not this again. So no, they're, of course, there's a degree of commercial decision-making that there has to be.
And in terms of the sort of the, I guess, fashions of genres and styles and what's in, obviously that changes over time, doesn't it? And there's a people, absolutely. You know, writers will try and chase the next insert, something that was big, Harry Potter, Da Vinci Code.
So true. Yeah, absolutely right. Yes, you do get these different trends, and they always go on for rather longer than I expect them to. I mean, I suppose the period when I was properly starting out and commissioning was the, certainly for in the women's market, was what that awful phrase chick lit, when chick lit became, you know, the start of authors like Marion Keyes and so on. Now it's, and this has gone on for really quite a long time, sort of psychological suspense, the girl on the train and Gone Girl and almost anything with girl in the title.
You know what you're getting if it's got girl in the title.
You know what you're getting. But it's extraordinary how long that's gone on for. And it seems to be a sort of insatiable market. That's fine if that's what people want. And it takes a real skill to write those kind of novels with, you know, the unexpected twist and so on. The only thing I'm suspicious of, and it has happened to me occasionally, if an author says to me, I don't quite know what to write next. What's selling? What's selling in the market? What shall I, you know, I'll write one of those. Because
my heart will be totally in it and I will do my very best.
And that will really show. You know, I mean, that's the thing. You just, you can't write for the market because, you know, whatever you're writing, it's got to be authentic and from the heart. You know.
Well, this is why we got you on, Joanna, so you could tell us what the next big thing is going to be. Using your years of experience and seeing how it's gone.
We're going to start writing it as soon as this podcast is finished.
So if we start it now, then, you know, what's the next big thing?
And then we'll all be really rich.
That's it.
It's pretty easy, really. Yeah, I'm not surprised no one's done this before.
Why didn't I think of that?
I don't know.
If only
so come on, what is it?
She does want to know.
You and me both. I mean, the sort of, it's such a broad category people have been talking about for a while, is this, and I kind of hate these terms as well, uplit.
Oh, yeah.
So it's basically, you know, novels that make you feel cheerful at the end, because everything else in real life is bleak at the moment.
You can see why that's popular,
exactly. But then alongside that, as I say, there's an insatiable market for the kind of creepy psychological thriller. So
let's assume the market's going to flip 180.
Yeah.
What we need is a really nice, pleasant story that ends really badly.
Well, yes.
Then I think we've got it.
Yeah.
We've got it.
maybe. Or there's this is already on its way, but there's the kind of resurgence of cozy crime. So the Richard Osmond of the world.
Yes.
You know, and a few years ago.
Oh, I bet publishers are being absolutely overwhelmed with that at the minute, though, in terms of people sending in stuff.
And I mean, with all due respect to him, he's basically created a trend, because I think if anonymous person had submitted a cozy crime novel a few years ago, publishers would have said, no, it's dated, it's not what the market wants. But because it's him, and out of his success, you know, he's bred a whole new trend for cozy crime, you know, which I guess is no bad thing.
Okay, so we basically, Tom and I, just need to get famous first.
Yeah,
is what you're saying.
It's easy, really.
Okay.
It's easy.
Then just write anything.
Yeah. All right, brilliant.
I wish I could tell you what the next big thing was going to be. But of course, nobody really knows until it happens, is the truth.
So, no, and it's one of those things that where no one really decides what it is. It just kind of happens somehow by some happenstance and chance, doesn't it? And
that's exactly right.
Everyone chases it for 5 years and then something else comes
exactly along. So I think that the moral of the story is actually to be brave and authentic and write the book or whatever it is that you really want to write.
That sounds like good advice. So after you worked in publishing, as in on the publishing side of things, you then became an agent.
Yes.
Why that move? Were you headhunted or was it?
It was not something I ever intended to do, but I was approached by AP Watt, as they were then. They've been subsumed into another agency since then. But AP Watt was the oldest literary agency in the world at that point. They used to represent people like Henry James. And so, you know, it felt like everybody's archetypal idea of Tweedy publishing. Why did I make that move? I was resistant to begin with. I mean, I went along for the meeting out of curiosity. And the thing that sort of swung it was they said to me, there are all different kinds of agents. And if you become an agent, you can do all the bits of being an editor that you love without having all the other corporate stuff that perhaps you don't love so much.
Tempting.
Yeah, it was tempting because I thought, actually, hang on a second. There are, you know, I can be an editing agent, which I very much was, and not all agents are. But my remit was to develop a list of sort of homegrown fiction, people who were just starting out, who I would then work with. And that's kind of what I've always done. And that for me was the great satisfaction. You find somebody and you think, you may just think this book needs a lot of work, but there's a germ of something really special there. Mm. And that's very exciting. And then you work with the author and bring out that talent. And then you manage to sell it. There's nothing more gratifying.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was that persuaded me, because on the publishing side, there are an awful lot of meetings and there is a lot of people sitting around a table not saying anything.
Yeah.
As you can imagine.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's like any creative industry. There's an awful lot of kind of hot air and politicking and all that kind of thing, which... and so being an agent, it was about, you know, the primary relationship with the author. Mm. And working with them. And that's what persuaded me. And then since I only stopped doing it because I had young children and I had a major back operation and decided that I couldn't do this. I'd moved to Oxford by then.
Right.
And so for a number of kind of more personal reasons, I went one step further back in the process. And now I work with authors who haven't even got an agent yet and help, you know, work with them editorially and then help to find them an agent, because I've still retained quite a lot of the, you know, contacts and friendships I had from publishing. Yeah.
So what does that entail then? Getting their manuscript up to speed and then...
Exactly.
And putting it out there.
So when I was an agent, I editorially tried to kind of work by a philosophy that I want to give a prospective editor as few possible reasons to say no as I could. You know, because, the mantra really is kind of, if in doubt, chuck it out, you know, because everybody gets so many submissions. So I would make sure that I got the author to get the manuscript as good as it could possibly be and polished and whatever, so that, you know, you make the life easy for an editor who thinks, wow, this is great and it's pretty much ready to go and I know how to sell it. So I now do the same thing, but one stage further back. So authors come to me, very often it's a first novel. They need some input from somebody else, because I'm sure you know, it's almost impossible to judge your own work, particularly.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
I'm going to be upfront now. I need you to sell me your skills, because I might actually even be interested in using your talents, because I'm quite close to finishing a book and I feel like I'm
going to... And it's rubbish and it needs quite a lot of help.
It's going to need a lot of work.
Yeah.
But how... Yes. Okay. So sell me the process. So I've got this book and...
A novel, I take it.
It's a novel, yeah.
It's a novel. Okay.
It's a sort of a murder mystery type thing.
Okay. So you would get in touch with me and say, I've written this book. I've written a novel. I can't tell whether it's any good or not. This is what I'm trying to do with it. But I feel I need somebody on the outside to assess it, tell me whether it works as a book in itself, tell me whether it has any potential in the marketplace. I mean, it's all those different aspects of it.
Mm.
I would then read the novel and give you editorial notes on what I thought worked and what I thought needed work.
I know which column is going to be longer there.
Do you ever read just like the first 10 pages and go... I don't think I can read any more of this.
There's your money back. Thanks very much. Yeah. Don't call me again.
Not very often, but I have done. Sometimes you can tell kind of straight away that, you know.
Just needs too much.
Yeah, or just that when somebody just really can't write.
Mm. Yeah.
And it is quite rare that that happens, but you can tell quite quickly if somebody just, you know, has just not got the first idea.
So if I hear back from you very quickly, that's when I ought to be a little bit nervous.
It's either because I've just, you know, been absolutely, you know, not been able to do anything else, I'm turning the pages so quickly, or it's no thanks. I mean, sometimes I can tell from the email I get beforehand. I mean, there are certain genres, for example, that I don't ever work on science fiction or fantasy, for example. It's just not a market I know. I don't have any knowledge or expertise or frankly any interest. I have a bit of a mental block.
But if you're charging by the page, fantasy must be a money spinner. because
that's true.
your amateur fantasy writer cannot keep it down below like 120, 150,000 words.
Yes. Maybe I have to rethink that one.
Although that in itself would be quite daunting, wouldn't it?
I know.
60,000 words in a thing. I'm not even halfway through yet.
There was one novel I read recently by an author whose work I really admire, but I was reading it on Kindle, so I had absolutely no idea before I started how long it was. And although I was loving it, it's actually one of my favourite novels. I was kind of thinking, oh my goodness, how long is this going on for? So I would then produce editorial notes, some markups on the page, some separate more general points, which you would have a look at, decide whether you agreed with them or not, and embark on any work that you felt you wanted to do. And then what usually happens is you'd resubmit to me, and either I'd say, nearly there, I think maybe you just need to do a bit more of X, Y, or Z, or I'd say, great, you've completely turned this around, let's send it to agents, I've proposed these 10 agents or whatever.
Right.
So that would be the process.
That sounds good. And do you mind me asking, how much would it cost for that initial consultation and then, you know, to move things forward? I'm guessing it depends on how much work there is involved, obviously. But
actually, it doesn't. My fees are on my website, and I can send you that. And I do it by number of pages.
All right.
For the simple reason that I came to the conclusion that to do it by length of time or amount of work that the book needs puts the author in a very difficult position of not knowing how much this is all going to cost.
Yeah. And deliberately writing very short books.
Yeah, exactly. I felt the fairest way to do it is by number of pages. Then they know up front what it's going to cost, regardless of how much. And that's my risk, because sometimes I have things that take way longer than I think they're going to. And other times where it takes much less because it doesn't need much work. By all means, take a look, and I'd be delighted to have a look at your novel. Have you been working on it for a while?
I have, yeah. I started at the beginning when we first started doing this podcast. We had, a murder mystery writer on, and we all wrote the first couple of pages of a murder mystery novel. And I quite enjoyed it, and I thought, I kind of know where the story's going, so I might as well see how I get on. And I just carried on. I actually started enjoying it. I didn't really think I'd enjoy writing it, but then I really got into it.
That's brilliant. I think that's a very good sign. I think if you're enjoying doing it, I think that probably reflects very well on what you've written. I always think that that feeling, I don't know if you've had this, when you're writing and you don't realize how much time has passed.
You're just
so wrapped up in it and so engaged in it, and it's kind of almost writing itself when it's going really well. I think very often that corresponds to something that's likely to be quite good. There's no feeling like it as well.
You're absolutely right with in terms of time passing very, very quickly. There's been a few occasions where I've forgotten to pick up the kids from school. Poor little devils stood there at the bottom of the road.
Toughen them up. And have you shown it to anybody so far?
No, I haven't. Not yet. No. We usually share things on the podcast, but I'm not there yet. I'm a little way off finishing it.
It's quite exposing, with fiction in particular, I think.
It's very exposing. Yeah, it is. Were you saying before, have you written novels as well?
I have. I've been on the other side of it, on the failing writer's side as well.
You've been on every bloody side of it,
haven't you? Apart from the successful writer's side. I wrote a novel, and it was tough because I spent a long time on it, and a long time editing it, refining it, send it out to a few agents. I deliberately chose agents that I didn't know. Because a lot of my contemporaries are still in the business, I wanted there to be no preconceptions.
Yeah, I get that.
And I had three agents wanting to take it on. And in fact, I went with one agent who I did already know because she'd asked to see it. And because she was, the others were younger, and I felt, having been an agent myself, I wanted to go with somebody who was even more experienced than I was. And she was very enthusiastic, and she sent it out to a whole bunch of editors, which was completely terrifying, particularly some of them I did know. And that's even more exposing if it's sent out to a whole load of your industry contemporaries.
This is as Joanna Frank.
Yeah, I was tempted to send it out under a pseudonym, but I don't want to play any games here. And one by one, that came the you know, I love this about it, but don't quite see it. You know, the rejections, which was devastating, as you can imagine. And I had a sort of period of mourning, and then I made myself sit down and write another one straight away, because I thought, if I don't do it now, I never will.
Oh, well done.
And that was just before the pandemic, and I'm still editing it all these 3 years later or whatever, because I do that in between doing everything else.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Also,
yeah.
Like a lot of people, I found it very difficult to do anything creative during the pandemic. And as some people have said, they've used that time to go off and write their novel, but I found it very difficult to focus on anything creative.
But do you, obviously you enjoyed the process of writing.
Yeah, of course.
It's not like you have to, you know, you're forcing yourself to do it.
No.
Or
no.
Anything like that.
No, the only issue is time, as I'm sure you're aware. It's finding the time, and it's sort of making the time when it's not the thing that's earning you any money. It sort of feels a bit like an indulgence. And can I really be allowed to do this thing, which actually I love doing, but, you know, it's not earning any money and I should be doing other things. So that's why I recognise that feeling of time passing and you just being really into it. And there's no better feeling. It's very kind of addictive. It's tough, as I say. I think we have to be masochists to be even trying, but, you know.
Your situation reminds me of the typical situation of a tradesman who's working all day and night tiling or whatever, but when they get home, their own kitchen hasn't been tiled.
It's a very good analogy. It's a, as I say, it's a sort of weird thing of not letting myself do it, even though it's the thing I most want to be doing. There's a feeling that it's a kind of indulgence. It would be different, I think, if you already had a contract and it was something you had to do.
That's right.
Yeah.
But that feeling of writing slightly into a vacuum without...
You are preaching to the thoroughly converted.
Yes, I know, sorry.
Yeah.
You know,
it's very difficult if you're the partner of a writer not to roll your eyes quite a lot, I think. Do you know what I mean? A lot of eye rolling.
Yes. Oh, you're going to do that again.
Wasting your time. Can we get down to some nitty gritty?
Because
as I said, I'm a good way through this this book that I'm writing, at some point I'd quite like to try my luck at querying some agents. So it would be great to have your expertise, and I'm sure it'd be very useful for our listeners too. So this is what I'm thinking. I'm thinking right here we could have a little feature, and I think we could create a little section of this episode, and we could call it "Let Me Be Frank." And you could maybe give us some, like, querying do's and don'ts.
Ooh.
What do you think? We'll make it very sort of magazine program.
Okay.
You know, bullet points with explanation. We might even put some sound effects in. Might have its own little theme tune. We'll see how it goes.
Oh, my goodness. No pressure.
So what do you reckon? Are you up for that?
I'll do my best.
Okay. Brilliant. Let's do it.
Let's be frank. Don't draw a blank when you query. Your last manuscript sank down the Armitage Shanks. Don't get teary. All you need are some do's, so your query improves, and a bunch of some don'ts. Hope you're taking some notes from the ultimate querying bank. It's Joanna Frank.
Should we start with some do's?
Do's, yeah.
Joanna, tell us some things that you absolutely must have or you must do in your query to an agent.
Do number one.
So research, first of all, research thoroughly into which agents you want to approach. So, for example, if you've written a fantasy novel, there's no point in sending it to an agent who's looking for thrillers, whatever.
So do
some research, have a look at their client list, see what other kind of authors they represent, come up with a short list. It is fine to submit to more than one agent at a time. Some people think you have to do it one by one. You don't.
All right.
Although there are a few agents who won't consider something unless they're being given it exclusively.
Do number two.
I think in a submission email, which is the all important document, I'd start by introducing yourself and how you came to be writing, where you're at with the book, a brief synopsis. Synopses, I and most authors feel, are kind of necessary evil. Nobody likes writing them.
How long are we talking?
Well, I would just say, for the letter, just a paragraph. a couple of paragraphs maybe if you need it, but it's a kind of overview of what your novel is, rather than a this happens and then this happens and this happens.
Yeah.
It's an overview of the book and which part of the market you feel it fits into. And that's really all you need, you know, as I say, apart from a sort of brief biography about you, a few lines about you.
And do you want to be dressing that up a little bit, make it sound actually more exciting than it really is?
Well, I don't think there's any point in being anything other than honest. I mean, a bit of embellishment in the way that you express yourself is fine. We all do it, don't we? But and obviously, if you've had any other accolades for, you know, short story competitions, anything else that's sort of... But the thing is just to be sort of fairly straightforward and obviously to be honest, but and show that you've done your research and that you're, you know, you're targeting that agent very specifically. You know, other agents have had this where you get an email, it's addressed Dear Sir, and you think you're just, you know, this is just a kind of, this is just an email that's being sent to everybody and you haven't even bothered to.
Yeah. I've been a big fan of insert such and such here, close brackets. Oh, I forgot to change it before I sent it.
Exactly. And so those are the kind of basic do's in terms of the actual, you know, the query document.
Do number three.
There's obviously all the do's about the material you submit. Usually people want the first three chapters, and I could give a whole creative writing lesson about what should be in that opening chapter, but obviously you want something on that first page that's going to grab the reader and hook them in.
Yeah, and I guess the overall idea being quite evident. Do you mean, so there's something for them to go, oh right, cool, this is a good idea.
Yeah, I get this.
Yeah, this is different.
Exactly, and where there's a distinctive voice as well, because obviously the voice, you know, I mean, obviously the narrative voice, whether it's third or first person, but that there's a confidence and a, confidence that the reader feels they're in safe hands and they're being led by the hand into a story. Some agencies will require a fuller manuscript beyond what you've put in your letter. Again, as I say, they're a kind of necessary evil because it's very difficult to make them sound interesting. And then this happened, and then that happened, and then, and some authors hate doing it because they then find it, if they've written the synopsis, it makes them feel like they've written the book, and then they find it really hard to write the book. But you just have to remember it's a selling document.
Yeah.
You know, you're using that document to sell yourself and tempt somebody to want to read the book.
Don't number one.
Don't try and make your submission stand out by using any kind of novelty. So I had one submission when I was an agent that was sent to me bizarrely in a sort of large Tupperware box. Somebody
with
who
a
was
sandwich in it.
Luckily not. Somebody was obviously trying to think of ways to make their manuscript stand out from everybody else's. I know, it's in a large green Tupperware box.
That's quite weird.
So don't do anything gimmicky.
But that ended up being, that was Jojo Moyes. So well done, Jojo.
No, that was J.K. Rowling, actually.
Don't number two.
Don't. Again, most agents will say on their websites, on the submissions page, how long you can expect to wait for a reply. So don't chivy too soon.
Yeah.
Some agents say if you haven't heard back from us, it means we're not interested. I think that's a bit tough. But if they say that, then you just have to accept it.
Don't! Number three!
Don't, if the agent comes back to you and says, I'm sorry, this is not for me, don't harangue them and protest.
Do argue with them. Oh, don't argue with them. Okay, interesting.
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised.
I'm sure I wouldn't actually. Yeah.
I've heard about some agents even getting kind of real abuse from authors for not taking on their novels.
And did that change their mind and lead to a book deal?
Well, yeah, obviously. And then they became a huge international bestseller because that's a really good approach to take. Clearly, we all respond well to that, don't we?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what could, really gets you on side.
Yeah, so don't email angry.
Don't email angry.
Don't number four!
And then just, you know, sensible presentation. As I say, most agents will have guidelines about how they want something presented.
Yeah.
So, but I think research is, you know, research is the most crucial thing apart from the quality of the writing itself.
Yeah.
Making sure you submit to the right people. And there are other ways as well of getting involved. I was emailing a client of mine today who's written a thriller. and we haven't managed to find him an agent, but he's got interest from a small independent publisher. I'm thinking about how he could sort of expand his knowledge of the genre. And so, for example, there are various different associations. So for unpublished authors, there's the Crime Writers Association.
Right, yeah.
Don't have to be published to join these organisations. Right. So you could join those organisations. They have events. You meet people in the industry who specialise in that area. You know, they go to talks, go to seminars. It's all about learning and making the contacts.
Yeah.
Which, you know, not all writers can do that if they're not mobile or whatever. But there's so much online now.
Don't! Number five!
Oh, and most importantly, don't give up.
Oh, that's good.
Don't give up, most importantly, because, again, as Louise said, it's very easy to become disheartened.
Mm.
If it's something you really want to do, just have to keep going and keep going.
Yeah. It's tough, isn't it? Because, you occasionally scrolling through Twitter, you'll see writers who are, like, on their 12th query and, the 12th book they've written without any joy. And you think, there must be a point at which you just go, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
However, I do think writers just write. It's just one of those awful things that you have to do.
Yeah.
When you have an idea that you think is a good idea, you just have to get it out of you somehow.
I think that's really true. But I agree with you. When you see those people who've been querying book after book after book, I'm sort of filled with not only compassion but admiration for the persistence.
God, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Much more than the bastards that come on and go, oh, I've just submitted a first book and I've got £250,000 advance. Is that any good? Is that normal?
Yeah, exactly. I just knocked it off over lockdown.
Yeah. All right, yeah. No, exactly. Well done. Well done.
So pleased for you.
Exactly. Hate that.
Really chuffed.
Exactly. If you're meant to get published, somebody will find you eventually.
Yeah. Or maybe you just need a really good literary consultant to help you along the way.
That's obviously not for me to say, but it certainly does have the potential to smooth your path.
Yes.
Speaking of which, I don't want you to choose your favourites or anything, but I bet there must be like one or two clients of yours who are like writers who you think are just brilliant and talented, but their careers just haven't taken off. Are there any future stars that are on, like, clients of yours that you might want to mention? Anyone kind of up and coming you think is just being horribly overlooked?
Yes.
Maybe someone that we might want to invite on the podcast to talk about their trials and tribulations. I don't know.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, the sort of current and former clients as a literary consultant. So I'd choose some two different areas. One is a thriller writer called Simon Berthon, Berthon, and he managed to find him representation, and he got a publishing deal with HarperCollins.
Fantastic.
And he writes kind of contemporary political thrillers, and he deserves a wider readership. I mean, we're talking sort of Robert Harris kind of territory.
Oh, yeah. Great,
yeah.
And so remember that name. I think he deserves a bigger audience.
Simon Berthon.
So in a completely different part of the market, sort of mainstream women's fiction, an author called Caroline Montague.
Okay.
She writes, when I say historical fiction, it's in near history, in 20th century history. Mm-hmm. Great big sweeping stories. They will have a love story in there, but there's more to them than that. She's an author I've worked with over several books. She's published by Orion. Her writing just got better and better and better. She's a fantastic storyteller, but she's got obviously, you know, ideally authors do improve with each novel. I think Louise was saying the same thing. Her characterization, she never has any problem coming up with stories, but her characterization has developed and improved. And I think characterization is one of the most important aspects to get right.
Yeah, yeah.
For a really immersive read, you've got to be rooting for the characters, don't you? I mean, again, it sounds obvious, common sense, but it's not something that's always the case. So Caroline Montague on the one hand, on the women's side, and Simon Berthon, contemporary political thrillers. Those would be my two who I think...
Fantastic.
Deserve and should get wider recognition.
All right. You heard it here first. That's fantastic.
Okay. Wonderful. Thanks so much, guys. Really appreciate it. Good luck
Thanks,
with
Jo.
The rest of the podcast.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.
All the best. Bye.
Cheers, Joe. Take care.
See ya.
Bye.
So we didn't quite manage to squeeze the next big thing in publishing out of there. I guess no one knows the answer.
No, it's a shame that, isn't it?
I mean, that would be good to know that, wouldn't
it?
Yeah,
that would be good to know.
As budding world rights, it'd be nice to be able to put that
Tom.
To use for the next big thing in publishing.
It really would. Yeah, it'd be nice.
That was fascinating, wasn't it, really?
It was.
Just like the journey Joanna's sort of taken through and kind of touched on all different angles
yeah,
of the publishing
exactly.
industry.
I'm very tempted to send my book to her when I finish it.
I think you should.
Yeah,
I think you should.
Yeah.
Definitely. I think she's obviously got a fantastic grasp of everything.
Oh, she knows her onions.
Yeah, yeah. Which is scary at the same time,
isn't
it, John?
It is, actually, because then she'll know exactly what's wrong
yeah,
with her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's
no hiding from that. I can't just dismiss her and go, yeah, well, she doesn't really know what she's talking about.
I think she said, didn't she, say, you know, it is scary.
Yeah. But that's what we want. That's what we're here for, Tommy.
It's what a world right's got to do, isn't it? It's in the blood. It's in the blood.
It is, exactly.
Any world right.
Mm.
I mean, to be fair, sending it to someone like Joanna, who's knowledgeable, talented, experienced, for her to have a look at your work is probably a really good idea, isn't it? Compared to, say, sending it to someone or some people who...
See where you're going with this now.
Don't have that experience, don't really know what they're on about.
Yeah.
And just bumble through.
I mean, who would do that?
Anyway, this week on our work in progress submissions, Scarlett has sent in some work for us to look at quite foolishly.
She has. Scarlett who, Tommy?
Scarlett, whose second name I haven't put on the notes that I'm reading on.
Sangster. It's Scarlett Sangster.
Scarlett Sangster.
Yeah.
And interested, there's a little bit of a link back with Louise Voss's book that Joanna was talking about. This is like massively linked.
Her first book, To Be Someone, where each chapter is based on a song.
This one is very much using Kate Bush songs as a spine and a feeling through the book, isn't it? So
sounds like it, yes.
Yeah.
Shall we have a quick listen anyway before we do anything else?
Yeah, great idea.
All right, let's do that.
Hate for the Ones We Love by S.G. Sangster. There is a figure that's adored, but I'd question very strongly that it's me, Kate Bush. 1993. The best view of London is from above. Flying into Heathrow from the east, the right wing dips and you can chart a full loop over the city skyline. The meandering Thames decorated with bridges and boats, Big Ben and the BT Tower, the Houses of Parliament look like playthings from the sky. Hyde Park, a postage stamp of mossy green among the rows of terraces. If you fly in by daylight, you can just make out the steady trickle of cars and buses, people on the pavements drawing tracks around each other, weaving and interspersing, places to go, lives overlapping. But landing at night is even more magical, when the city is a sleeping ocean of stars. The landing tonight was one of the clearest I've ever seen. After 13 sleepless hours from Japan, topping up champagne and heating pre-made portions of Chateaubriand, I buckled into my favourite window seat and lost myself in the descent. Those 15 minutes between soaring above the clouds and touching ground are the closest I've ever come to feeling truly free. I often wonder, as I'm moving through the airport in the early hours, if everyone around me has also lived multiple lives. I myself have been many different people, in many different places. In some ways, that's the greatest gift of my job. I get 100 second chances, a different mark left on every city around the globe. The new romantic, the career woman, the evangelist, the thrill seeker, the lost girl looking to be found. All of these people are me, but I cannot say that I'm wholly any of them. 3 hours later, I step out of Putney Station. The morning is hazy and dim, the sun only just breaching the crest of the Victorian pub on the corner. I wrap my coat closer around me and take the handle of my suitcase. Even at this hour, the pavements are starting to fill, commuters on their way to work as I make my way home. Home to the most conventional of my lives, and the one that's taken the most courage to curate. I let people step off the pavement to move around me, acknowledging their disgruntled murmurs and letting them wash away. Then, two blocks down, I take the road on my left and come to a stop at a narrow doorway tucked to the right of an Irish 24/7. Water drips from the awning as I fish through my coat pockets for my keys and struggle with the lock. The familiar metallic scent of lavender room spray and garlic bread greets me as I shunt my suitcase up the narrow stairway, careful not to knock the oversized Art Deco prints from the walls. One for every musical Julian's conducted, plus a few he hasn't. I reach the first floor, abandon my bags, and head straight for the kitchen. A covered bowl and handwritten note wait beside the microwave. My best one yet. Kiss. There's never any doubt what I'll be eating when I get home from a flight. It's the only thing Julian can cook. I'm not hungry, but I don't want to hurt his feelings. So I put the carbonara on full power for 3 minutes and move over to the wine rack, perpetually filled with half-finished cast offs brought home after press nights. I peruse the labels, then pluck out a bottle of Rioja and pour myself a large glass. The clock on the oven reads 8:05. My body sighs as the drink slows my thoughts, allowing the other senses to fight for attention. The ache in my feet and the itch of my neck scarf. I kick off my heels and tug at the knot around my throat. When the microwave bleeps, I set myself up at our makeshift breakfast bar and let the briny smell of pasta and bacon escape in a cloud as I lift the lid on my dinner. At least the food might help me sleep, I suppose. Twisting spaghetti around my fork, I try to savour the silky texture of cream and egg, though it clashes with the coarseness of the wine, ever so slightly corked. Only one glass, I tell myself. Just one today. The flat is southeasterly facing, and as I eat, the morning sun slowly envelops the room in a tea-tainted glow. I've come to relish this hour of calm, the mellow come-down after a run of back-to-back flights. This, my time to adjust. To become reacquainted with my character and the safe, simple life that is somehow mine. It's easier to bring back sometimes than others, and for some reason, this morning, I'm struggling to settle. A sharp two-tone ring sets my fork clattering to the floor, the rhythm of my heartbeat accelerated from 0 to 50. I run out into the hallway and unzip the front of my suitcase. Shh. I say pointlessly, hushing the phone as I pull up the antenna, just seconds too late. With the phone now silent in my hand, I glance down the hall to where Julian will still be sleeping. But all seems still. I press the phone to my chest, as though that might somehow dampen the noise if it rings, and head back into the kitchen. Reclaiming my fork, I settle myself and dial for voicemail. I balance the phone against my shoulder so I can twirl another fork of spaghetti.
To listen to your message, press 1. To save your message...
I take the mouthful and click 1. For a moment, the whole room goes dark. A cold wave rising, crashing, dissolving everything real and present and replacing it with bright, vivid images, flashing behind my eyelids like a film reel. They lift me up and turn me over, an awful cacophony of emotions dragging me to the seabed. Funny how you can convince yourself the past is forgotten, only to have the illusion shattered in a single word. Kathy. Only one person has ever called me Kathy.
Ooh, very nice. And thank you to Katie Rand there for her beautiful rendition of Scarlet's piece.
Yes, thank you, Katie. Nice reading that was. Lovely.
My first question, before we go anywhere else, Tommy, what was your sense of what the genre is here? Did you kind of grasp that?
You mean from like the first bit, from the bit we've heard? No, I guess not, no.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? I had a similar thing, because we've got this flight attendant who wants to sort of reinvent themselves or has reinvented themselves over and over in different places. And so this is a character that obviously likes to live different lives. And that's already quite intriguing to start with. But we originally didn't have any information about the piece, did we? Or the genre? Because Scarlett didn't send us initially a log line or anything or a premise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So my head went straight to, is the flight attendant job a cover for something a bit more like espionage-y?
Oh, right, okay.
Did you? No, you didn't go there?
No, not in the slightest,
no. Because then I read on after that, and I'm thinking, well, that's obviously not where it's going, because we're now moving on to a girl who wants to, like, run away from the life she has. from this teenage life. This is the following chapter from the one you've just heard. And she still sees herself as an outsider. She's got a life with an absent mother and a physically and psychologically broken father. But it was very difficult to predict what was going to happen. I couldn't work out the genre, which I thought was quite interesting, because often you kind of know straight away, don't you?
Yeah. I think I probably thought, after reading further, that it was kind of that sort of coming of age,
yeah,
sort of drama.
More of a maybe a love story, but something a bit darker involved.
Yeah, and the love story like not necessarily being the top line of it, but being a huge influence on that kind of development.
Yeah.
So I guess, yeah, I guess it's the, I guess the idea is that in that first chapter, we're seeing sort of maybe halfway, three quarters of the way through the story as we're being told it.
Yeah, exactly.
And that there's sort of a further development and denouement after that to kind of see where the character gets to and how she succeeds, I guess, in changing and leaving that life behind or accepting what that early life was. And because that's the thing, isn't it? She just seems on such unsure ground a little bit. And it's almost like that flight attendant thing mirrors what we learn later on about her early childhood.
Yeah.
That she's always on, she always just feels slightly out of place or not quite.
That's right, the outsider looking to fly.
Yeah. So maybe that's a very clever metaphor.
I think it might be, yeah. The Kathy thing as well, I thought, that sounds like a Kate Bushism.
Which, I think it is. Wuthering Heights. That was a great thing to drop in, wasn't it? It's just I like the ones where it's just dropped in and left and there's no further explanation needed on that.
Yeah. Of course, after we'd read it, I sent Scarlett an email just saying, do you have a short premise or something, just so we can find out a bit more about the book itself and where it goes from here? So I'll read you the teaser that she sent. She says, it's 1978 and Jen isn't planning on A-levels. With her dad's disability only paid every 2 weeks, extra shifts at the local pub could be her only hope of escape. Until she meets Russell, an older boy who tells Jen she can't pull a pint and she looks like Kate Bush. And what you don't know, listener, is that each of the chapters appear to be named after Kate Bush songs.
They do now. Do you know one of the things that got me about this, that kind of hooked me in a little bit, was that very first line, the start. I thought it was lovely, a lovely way in.
Mm.
The best view of London is from above. I think that's such a gentle, good first line.
It is a very nice first line, isn't it?
It tells you so much.
It tells you about the character.
It puts you in the place of London. Yeah. It's, you're thinking, you know, there's an element of a why it's above, but you can picture it very
slight surprise.
I just thought it was a really tidy way into the story.
Yeah, I agree. Very good. Yeah, she can tell a story.
Using our years of experience and massive what are you laughing?
Nothing. I'm not laughing, Tom.
Using our masses of experience and writing talent as promising world rights in our own right. Was there anything that you felt needed tightening up or brushing up on or anything in that?
I didn't have like really strong feelings about that, if I'm being totally honest. It seemed to flow very nicely.
Yeah.
I always think in these circumstances you could probably lose more than you sort of realise.
Yeah, there's probably that.
You can always kill your babies a little bit more, because it felt like, and maybe it was to do with not quite understanding what the genre was, but I think I wanted to get to the hook maybe a little bit quicker. But actually, having said that, I was intrigued.
Yeah,
you know, I was intrigued enough by the setup in the very first chapter, and I was intrigued how this, you know, the girl character, the teenage girl character, is going to go from there to the flight attendant.
I think part of it was very well done in that I felt, after reading it, I actually felt like I knew quite a lot about the protagonist, but I didn't feel that I'd been told that much. But when I got to this kind of the end of those chapters, I thought, oh yeah. I feel like as a reader, we've discovered it organically rather than being kind of exposition and kind of, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was delivered very gently, wasn't it?
It was.
Which can kind of leave you feeling like it's not giving you enough and not moving long enough, but it's kind of unfair that, because it's been delivered very subtly.
Yeah. And I think actually the character seems to be someone who doesn't give a lot of herself away, like deliberately.
Yeah, yeah.
Like when she's interacting with her friends as well, she's not massively sociable, is she? So it's almost like she's holding back anyway. So she's holding back from us and from the people around
her. Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
So it works.
And I think part of picking up on that was I felt Scarlett dealt with the dialogue really well in that. I felt it ran very smoothly and ran very nicely together.
Yeah, yeah, I'd agree.
I think the only thing that I thought that if I was kind of trying to be critical was I wondered if there was a little bit more sort of world detail that could be put in there to kind of spell out the sort of the era and the time a bit more. So when they're walking down the promenade or whatever with it, do you mean that there's a few more sort of
from
sights
that,
and smells yeah. and feel of where they are
from that period from the 70s?
Yeah, there's maybe quite sort of insular in the protagonist's head and what we're learning, and that maybe there just needed to be a tiny bit more of outside world being brought into it to give sort of an atmosphere and a feeling to it.
Hmm.
There were a few things. I don't know. I might be completely wrong.
I can remember a few things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, I don't know. I might be completely wrong. that's what we're here for, isn't
that's
it?
That's it. Yeah.
But I think there was a line in there, you know, that made me think at the end of it, kind of made me go back to it to think if that this was like a little microcosm of everything that she was feeling, the character in the story, where she's in the sea. And she says, I cast my eyes out to the end of the world, to where the water grew dark and flat and the sun sparkled like hope.
Yes, nice.
I thought that was a fantastic line, that, in how it conveys she's in such a like sort of a dark, foreboding place.
But way off on the horizon is something.
Yeah, but the sun sparkled like hope as well. It's not even that it is hope. It's like almost like, is it the light at the end of the tunnel or is it the train coming towards you sort of thing? I think maybe there's a,
She's good.
Yeah.
She's good.
Yeah, yeah.
She knows what she's doing.
Yeah, really enjoyed that.
Well done, Scarlett.
Be interesting to know whether that's a finished piece, as in whether the rest of the book exists, how much of a work in progress it is, or whether
where on
the point of progress is that work.
Let us know, Scarlett. That'd be good to know. Well, that was good.
Yeah, there's more service to the writing community. Sorry, to the world write community.
Thank you. Do you know what I think we should end with, Tommy?
I don't know.
You had a good long think, though.
I don't. Is it rhetorical? You're just going to tell me, or do I actually have to guess?
No, I was expecting you just to go. No, John.
Right. Okay.
What should we end with?
No, John. What shall we end with?
I think we should end with Joe Frank's little message to Louise Voss, which I've got hopes that Louise will listen to, and she'll be so inspired by that she'll go and write another book, and then that will become a massive global bestseller.
Yeah.
And Louise will be so grateful to us.
Yeah.
She'll probably gift us like £1 million each.
Brilliant. Yeah, no, we should do that.
Yeah, so let's do that.
It's worth playing just in case, then, isn't it?
Yeah.
If she becomes a mega famous world right, that'd be good.
Exactly.
I'm trying.
You're doing a great job. I really appreciate it, Tom. Thanks, man. Payback for all that enthriting talk I've been doing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you scratch my back. I'll scratch yours. So, yeah, here's what Joanna had to say to Louise.
If I was still an agent, I would definitely want to still be representing her. I've read recent novels of hers and I still absolutely believe in her talent 100% after all these years. And I'd want to say to her, please, please, for the sake of your readers, don't give up.
So you would hope Louise couldn't fail to be moved by that and get back behind that typewriter, get back on the horse, typewriter.
That's what it feels like, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Her old favourite agent from many years ago. It's got to have an impact.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for listening, everybody. It's been very nice hanging out with you again. What have we got coming up next, Tom?
Next week, we are speaking to Jack Meggett Phillips, who is a children's author who wrote several books in the series The Beast and the Bethany, which are a particular favourite in our household. And we have a good old chat with him about writing and stuff.
That's weird, isn't it? What a surprise.
Yeah. Just what came up, really, when we had a chat with him.
He was a very jolly chap.
He was a lovely, lovely guy. And, it's really interesting hearing his little story of landing a massive deal on his first book. It's brilliant, that, yeah. Good. Good for him.
Ouch.
So we look forward to that.
We do. We always look forward.
Jack Meggett Phillips with his...
All right, Tom, stop it.
Successful.
Stop, just can't stop it. Career. All right. Just say goodbye to everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
See ya.
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?